Welcome to Christ Church Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com. My home is not on this
earth, not in this world. So there are key moments in discipleship, often moments where it just seems to click, like there is some sort of tipping points. And often we don't realize it's happening until perhaps we look back over our life and we can see that something has shifted in that moment. Our heart has changed, whether we made a big decision or we just know an attitude's changed. And it is often a heart moment where God does something in us to prepare us maybe for what's going to happen in the future, or maybe just to change our hearts so that we're able to worship God with an area of our life that we haven't been able to previously, or it's to shape us, or simply it's to grow us up a little bit, sometimes just to bring us into some maturity. And the absolute worst thing about those moments is you don't quite realize it's happening when you're in the middle of it. I don't know if you've experienced that, but you don't realize you can be stuck in a situation that might be quite painful, quite uncomfortable, and you just don't realize that God is doing something. God is using that time to maybe bring some healing, maybe bring some restoration to you, or simply just to change your heart. And in that moment, really, you just want it to be over. When you're in a difficult time, nobody says, yeah, I'd like it to last for as long as possible. I'm sure it's good for me. Really, you would say, I'd quite like it to finish quite soon, please. This is quite uncomfortable. So when we started in Fallowfield, which is nearly 10 years ago, we planted the site there. I decided in my wisdom, and I was wise, I decided in my wisdom that I would ban Colin Barron, who's the kind of leader of CCM, from ever turning up to this meeting or having any level of involvement. And there are a couple of things you need to understand. Firstly, Colin is about 25,000 years older than me. Also, he has planted lots of churches, led lots of churches, helped lots of church planters, helped to run a whole global movement of churches, actually. But I decided in my wisdom of never having done any of those things ever, that I didn't need his help. So I asked him if he would politely not show up. And actually, he was very kind and didn't show up for about 6 months. First 6 months, he didn't turn up at all. By the time he finally did one evening, I remember him coming in to Bar Bar on the top floor of the most skanky vodka bar there is in all of Fallowfield. He turned up and I was so pleased to see him. I was overjoyed to see him because by that point I'd realized I didn't have the first idea of what I was doing and was largely clueless, and that actually leading and planting churches was much more difficult than I had allowed myself to believe. And that was a very painful moment, but it was a discipleship moment. A bit between me and Colin, but really between me and Jesus. Jesus worked on my heart at that time, said some very difficult things to me about my own level of independence, my own level of self-sufficiency. I quite fancy myself as a bit of self-contained. I can really sort myself out, look after myself. I don't need much help. Thank you very much. So obviously Jesus worked on my pride as well. And as I look back on that, I see lots of things that God did in me in that moment. And at the time, I had a vague inkling that perhaps that might be what he was doing. But as I look back now, I can see it very clearly. And so I want us to think about these discipleship moments this morning. And we're going to look at a very big one for the disciples in a second. But just to ponder for yourself, to wonder, where am I at in my discipleship with Jesus? And that's a big thing. Whether Jesus actually is pushing some buttons in you at this time. And I would like to suggest that he absolutely is. You just might not know it. I wonder as well if we could perhaps realise what he's doing and then work with him and allow him to work on us and to change us. So we're going to read about a key discipleship moment in the lifetime of Jesus' disciples. And actually, next Sunday morning, Andy Brownlee will be here and he will talk about how Peter actually declares that Jesus is the Christ. And it's a big moment in the Gospel of Mark. It's a big breakthrough. Mark has spent 8 chapters working up to this moment, and then the 8 chapters after that working up to Jesus' death and then resurrection. And so we are coming up, we're just getting to that, but we're not going to get it today. But we're going to understand that actually something big needed to happen in their hearts before they could declare that, before that could happen. Jesus actually needed to really provoke and unlock some things. So we're going to read it through and we're going to unpack this discipleship moment. And we have been looking at the Gospel of Mark, and we're going to look at Mark 8, 1 to 21. And we're going to kind of read and reflect and read and reflect our way through this passage, okay? So stick with me. So let's read the first few verses. And it says, "In those days when a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples and said to them, 'I have compassion on the crowd because they've been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. Some of them have come from a far away.' And his disciple answered him, 'How can one feed these people with bread in this desolate place?'" Okay, let's pause here. Now, I don't know if you've read the Gospel of Mark cover to cover, like in one go. But if you did, you would read this story and think, hang on a minute. Hang on a minute. I have a sense of deja vu. This feels oddly familiar. And then you would flick back a few pages and realize that Jesus had kind of done this once already. Jesus fed 5,000. And we talked about this here a few weeks ago. He fed 5,000 in a similar situation, in a desolate place. He fed them because this crowd had come to them and he needed to look after them. And he had compassion for them. Okay, so you think this is a very similar event. And some people think, well, Mark is just telling the same story again. He wanted to get a different theme out of it this time, so he just reuses the story. Because really, how many times do you need to feed thousands of people? But actually, it's a brand new event. It's in a different place. This time, Jesus is in the kind of Gentile territories, the non-Jewish territories around the edges of Israel. It was also a very different time of year. There are clues that tell us it's a different time of year. There's also a different number of people that are there. So Jesus fed 5,000. This time, it's 4,000. But the disciples are exactly the same. The disciples' hearts are exactly the same as they were last time. You see, they asked that question. But well, let's pause before we get on to what's going on in the disciple. So we can see that actually Jesus is for the big picture. So Jesus understands the whole universe and realizes he is for the whole universe. Okay, he is for everyone. So the word compassion that Mark uses here, it's not like he's seen all these hungry people and he thinks, "Ah, oh, it's a shame, isn't it? I feel sorry. All right, well, we'll source some food from somewhere. It'll be fine." Actually, it's a deep kind of feeling in his guts, a deep motivation. Actually, thinking some of these people have traveled far. They might faint. And it's more than that. They're going to be my people. These people are for me. He is desperate for them to not miss out on bread, actual food, but on him himself, him being the bread of life. And Jesus has a deep compassion for these people. So these 5,000 originally, the first story, they're in Israel. Like we said, these 4,000 actually, they are Gentiles. And Jesus again is saying, look, I'm here for the whole world. This compassion, this love, this desire to have all of humanity be in my family, actually that is for everybody. It's not just for the Jewish people, it is for everyone. It's not an exclusive thing. And he's doing this again because he wants his disciples, this group of people that have been following around, to become big picture people as well. And at the moment, they are very small picture people. And he's like, look, I want you to understand the breadth of what I am doing. So then Jesus leaves. I've missed a few lines of my own notes. It's not very good, is it? Right, okay. So he wants his disciples to become big picture. And actually, they will become big picture. So if you read the book of Acts, you will see that these disciples actually become very big picture. They are fired off into Europe and into Asia. And actually, they do incredible things. They do more than Jesus does. But at this point in time, they are not quite there. They can actually only see what's in front of them. And the disciples ask a question. They effectively say, okay, how are we going to do it, Jesus? There are all these thousands of people. How on earth are we going to do that? Now, if you've read the whole of Mark in one sitting, you think, well, he's done it once already. I don't quite understand what your problem here is, disciples. And Mark wants us to feel that tension. Think, you've seen this before, but you still don't understand it. Now, an interesting thing about the letter that Mark wrote, the book that he wrote, many people think it was actually the reflections of Peter. Okay, that Mark and Peter were very close. They worked together in Rome. And it's thought that Mark wrote this letter either right before Peter died or just after he died, like as his reflections. And so Peter is perhaps reflecting this himself, saying, yeah, I saw this twice and I still didn't get it. And this would have been written to the church he was at in Rome. So perhaps if it was before he died, perhaps when this letter was read out in a church meeting and they were being taught from it, a few people turned round in the church and looked to Peter and said, you saw 5,000 people fed and then 4,000 and you still didn't understand that Jesus could feed lots of people. You can almost see Peter sitting at the back going, yeah, well, it was hard. I didn't know what was going on. So actually, there's a lot of humility in this story, which I really like. But Jesus worked a miracle. He worked some incredible provision, didn't he, when he fed those thousands. And yet they forgot. They forgot. How do you do that? Has that ever happened to you where God may have spoken something into your life or worked out something in your life, whether that's some great provision that he's helped you with or something that he has settled in you or some other prayer that he has answered or just knowing that God has been with you and done some stuff. And then a while later, when you face a similar situation, you're worried again. You're kind of racked with that nervousness of where's God? Is he going to help me? What's going to happen? When we moved to Manchester, in order to God to get us here, he gave me 4 dreams about moving to Manchester, a few prophetic words. I mean, I've never had it before in my life or since where God has like a loud hailer in front of your face shouting at you. And people are like, oh, that must be mate. I think it was probably because I was a little bit deaf. And so he had to really rank up the volume for me to be able to hear him. And he spoke so clearly. But there have been a number of times since then where we very nearly walked away. We're like, this is too difficult. I don't want to do this anymore. I'd forgotten God. I'd forget him. Perhaps this is what happened to the disciples. But what caused them? Okay, what was going on in their hearts? Because Jesus really is pulling this to pieces. This is a big discipleship moment for them. Now, actually, after he fed the 5,000, they got into a boat with him because he'd walked on the water by them. So they fed the 5,000, or Jesus did. He went off to pray. They got in the boat. They went out into the lake. There was lots of storms. And then they see Jesus walking on the water. And he gets into the boat with them. The winds stop. And it says in Mark 6, they were utterly astounded. And you think, yeah, you would be astounded if you'd seen someone walk on water. But that's not the thing that astounded them. It says they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves. Okay, they just didn't understand what Jesus had done then, but their hearts were hardened. They had hardened their hearts to Jesus. You think, well, why did you do that? Seeing something incredible like that, surely that would provoke faith in you, seeing these miracles, seeing God do stuff like that. Why? What happened there? What's going on? Actually, this is a very key discipleship moment for them. A key moment where God is doing stuff right in front of them, asking them to be involved, and yet they don't understand, and so they are retreating. They are backing away from God. They're in a very difficult moment, actually. It's really hard for them at this point. We need to understand that actually it would have been baffling what was in front of them. The trauma of being in the boat in the storm and then Jesus walking on the water. This was difficult stuff. Jesus was asking them to grow and learn a lot. And instead of going with what Jesus was doing, they retreat from him. They harden their hearts towards him. So let's keep reading because Jesus tackles this. So they are standing there in front of these 4,000 people, and the disciples say, well, how can you feed these in this desolate place? How on earth are you going to do it? And Jesus said, okay, let's do this again, shall we? How many loaves do you have? And this time they have 7. He said, we have 7. And he directs the crowd to sit down. He took the 7 loaves, gave thanks. He broke them, gave them to the disciples to put before the people and set them before the crowds. And they had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said that these also shall be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. They took up the broken pieces left over, and there were 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away. And immediately got into the boat again with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. So it's fascinating what happens here. Jesus really takes charge. When he was feeding the 5,000 in the first story, the disciples were a little bit more involved. He had them doing a bit more stuff. This time it really is Jesus kind of giving the orders, making these things happen. And actually it's a brief picture of Jesus, kind of how he operates, of how he gets things done, regardless of the faith level of the disciples. And they've almost regressed in their faith. And actually, he still uses what little they've got. Even if they've forgotten what God had done before, even if there's a hard-heartedness and cynicism, he still takes the very tiny amount that they have and expands it beyond all human logic. Yesterday, a few of us from CCM were at a conference run by a group of churches called Catalyst that we're part of. They have a conference for church leaders and people leading in business. And so there were about 200 or 300 of us there. And I was asked to interview Victoria Armstrong, who runs the Oasis Centre. And Victoria tells a story, and she told this story in front of this crowd. And you could see why, eyes being wide at what she told. But effectively, how God gave her the land that this new centre is being built on for £1. And then how she has raised £1.1 million. Now, that is a tiny bit of bread beyond human logic, isn't it? There, in that one moment. And when we read Mark, when we read his gospel, actually some people say this is a gospel of action and activity. Okay, so it's not really much of theology, it's just a thing Jesus does. But actually this is a deep statement, an explanation of how God works in the universe. And how God works into us, even when we're hard-hearted. And how God sometimes works in spite of us. He is desperate for us to fulfill the role that he would have for us. Desperate for us to work with him, to work alongside him, to move his kingdom forwards. And actually, he's not too worried about where we're at in our heart. In that moment, he can still use what's there. So let's keep reading. Mark accelerates the story as he does. It says, then the Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighs deeply in his spirit and said, why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. And he left them, got into the boat, and he went to the other side. So what happens here is a classic Mark technique of telling a story. What he does is he gets a whole story, and then right in the middle of that story, he puts another story, like the filling in a sandwich. And that filling in the sandwich is supposed to change the flavour of the whole thing, okay? So he puts this story right in the middle, so we learn a bit more about the whole story. So these Pharisees don't turn up as an unexpected interruption. Actually, he puts these guys in here, said, look, this is an important point for you disciples to understand. So the Pharisees, they turn up to confront. Okay, this is not a fact-finding mission. This is not a mission to see if they can learn a bit more and their hearts change. This is an attack, a full frontal attack on Jesus. We're here to bring you down. We're here to argue with you. Contrast this to the Syrophoenician woman that we talked about, I think, last week. Okay, so she approaches Jesus. She was a Gentile, so she should have been outside the people of God in a time that was very racist. She wasn't a Jew, so she shouldn't have been able to get before Jesus. She was also a woman, and so she shouldn't have been able to get before Jesus for being a woman. And also her daughter was demonized, so she was fully kind of integrated into pagan cult life. So she should not have been able to get in front of a Jewish teacher. She was a total outsider. But she gets there, she throws herself at Jesus' feet in an act of humility and an act of belief. And compare her to the Pharisees who turn up. Pharisees are in the people of God. They are Jews, so they should be able to get before Jesus. They're also men, which really helps them. And there's no sense of any pagan worship about them. They're very keen that they worship God in the right way. And yet they turn up to attack. The religious turn up to defeat, not to learn. And actually, this is a picture of unbelief. And this is really where Jesus is getting to here. These Pharisees are a picture of unbelief. And unbelief is very different to doubt, okay? And doubt is asking questions, approaching God, genuinely searching for truth. Unbelief approaches God to attack him, to say, why don't you behave in the way I want you to? That's what unbelief does. That's what those Pharisees were doing. And there's a question there for us, for the disciples. Actually, how are you approaching God's? Do you approach like the Syrophoenician woman? Do you approach with humility? Do you put yourself in front of Jesus? Do you push through in order to get there because you are desperate? Or do you approach like the Pharisees, where you say, God, why aren't you doing what I want you to do? I need you to do this. Why aren't you doing it? And the Pharisees turn up and they demand a sign. This is fascinating, actually. You think, okay, Jesus just fed 4,000. After that, before that, he healed some people. Before that, he fed another 5,000. And yet these people turn up and say, we'd actually quite like a miraculous sign to show us what you've been doing. And you think, well, hang on a minute, there've been plenty. And you realize that they were never there. The Pharisees weren't there. They keep appearing at inopportune moments to attack and demand things. But actually, they're not following Jesus. They're not watching him. They're not listening to him. They're not kind of devoting time to him. They're just turning up to attack. And it's not that they just want to witness another one of Jesus' miracles. They want something specifically for them. We want you, basically, to design a sign for us. Actually, we've got some schematics here of what we would like this sign to look like. These are some diagrams we've come up with in committee. We want you to behave in this way, please. Do these things, and then we'll believe, possibly. They want God to conform to their expectations, which actually is toxic behavior. It's poison to you to just say, actually, God, you should behave like the way that I want you to do the things I want you to do, please. Actually, that's a massive killer, destroyer of faith and hope. And Jesus knows it. Jesus sighs deeply in his spirit. This is a sigh of dismay, of despair. There's almost something despondent about this. Why? Why? Why do you people keep behaving like this? It's the low point of Mark's gospel. And you think, well, okay, his death must be the lowest point. But actually, this is a big statement about his people, the people of God that are meant to follow him. He sighs deeply in his spirit. And then he says, this generation, why does this generation seek a sign? And this generation, actually, that phrase is a massive clue. It comes up time and again in the Old Testament. In Genesis 7, it says, this generation, when it's talking about how Noah's family are the only righteous family in this generation. People have got to fall into pieces there. Psalm 95 says, where God says, actually, this generation have gone astray in their hearts. They've walked away from me. Deuteronomy 32 says, God says, this generation are crooked and twisted. This generation have fallen to pieces. And Jesus says this. Why does this generation need a sign? What is it with this people? It's their unbelief. A total lack of trust in God that manifests itself in an annoyance that God doesn't do what they want him to do. Doesn't behave in the way that they want him to. Which is a huge problem in God's people. We see it come up time and again. A disease that keeps reappearing. And actually, their unbelief, this heart problem, won't be fixed by another sign. Jesus could have done any sign he wanted at that moment, but he just walked away because he knew, actually, it won't be fixed. The sign won't be quite correct. We've seen it throughout their history. It's a deep heart problem. So Jesus gets back in the boat and leaves them. We get to the end of that section of the story. And let's read what happens. They're in the boat. They are going away from these Pharisees who've been arguing with Jesus. And it says, now they had forgotten, these are the disciples, they had forgotten to bring bread. They only had one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why are you discussing the fact you have no bread? Do you not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? It's one of those questions where he knows the answers. Yes, they are. Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? Do you not remember? And when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets of broken pieces did you take up? And they, disciples, said to him, well, 12. And the 7 for the 4,000, what we've just done, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, well, 7. And he said to them, do you still not understand? So when Jesus is floating away from the Pharisees, he actually hasn't left the opposition behind him. They are still sat in the boat with him, his disciples. They are having a ridiculous conversation in this moment. If you really think about this conversation, they are sat in the boat and they have realized, oh, we've only got one loaf of bread. Why? Why did we do that? Why did we forget the breads? There's only one loaf between all of us. What are we going to do for lunch, effectively? Who's in charge of lunch? This has gone wrong. And you can imagine Jesus sat there as they're arguing about one loaf of bread, eyes wide. What am I hearing? What are you lot talking about? What have you just seen? What have you just seen? Well, you've witnessed me feed thousands of people. And I did it twice, by the way. And now you are concerned about lunch for 13 people. Okay, so let's do some of the maths here. I should be able to deal with that, shouldn't I? And so he warns them. Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, the people who had just been giving him a hard time, the leaven of Herod. Actually, this is a little bit, if you think about it, offensive. Jesus has been a little bit rude to them here, I would suggest. Saying, watch out for the Pharisees, watch out for the Herodians, what their attitude is. You don't want to be like that. And it's a bit offensive because these guys sat in the boat with him. They left family, they left jobs. They are walking around with Jesus. They're following him as he goes from place to place, listening to him, helping him actually feed the 5,000 and the 4,000, doing little bits and bobs here and there. And the Pharisees have done none of that. They've kept their distance. The Herodians as well, the kind of rulers of the land, have done none of that either. In fact, they're plotting to kill Jesus, which they will ultimately succeed in. And it seems a bit unfair that Jesus is comparing the two of them, doesn't it? Actually, he's getting to the very root of the problem. And this is their key discipleship moments. This is the bit where when they write it in their journals and look back a year or two later, they'll be like, ah, okay, I see what God was doing there. He's saying, look, the root of unbelief, what you see in the Pharisees, the corruption, and they were corrupt. The hypocrisy that is within them. The deep cynicism that says the world should be as I want it to be. Their arrogance as well, saying, actually, I know better than who God is. Their self-sufficiency. Actually, if we all obey the rules that we have set, then everything will be fine. Also, the joyless religiosity of these people. I mean, they were no fun. All of that is a tiny organism that Jesus calls leaven, which is a bit like yeast. It's nearly invisible, but once it gets in, once it's in your heart, it grows, doesn't it, rapidly. A tiny amount of this in a batch of bread changes the whole lot, doesn't it? All suddenly changes. Changes the very nature of what that bread is. Quickly infects everything. The Pharisees' problem, which is stark and obvious, and it's easy for us to look at and go, they are the bad guys. We can see that. That's pretty clear. But that problem is in the heart of the disciples. Jesus is not behaving in the way that they expect him to. Their hearts are hard. It says they harden their hearts to what Jesus was doing. There is a deep brokenness within them, within the whole people of God. This is a key moment in their life, key moment in their discipleship. Perhaps it's a key moment that only 11 of them got. Actually, the 12th one, Judas, never seemed to quite grasp this, did he? Perhaps only some of them really got it. But Jesus is always working on us. Actually, with the clear intention, look, I want you people to be like me. I have a great job, a great task that I want you to get involved in. Actually, I want you to advance my kingdom far beyond the borders of what I'm here to do. You're going to go off into Europe, you'll go off into Asia, and then the next generation will go even further than that. Next generation after that will go even further. I'm going to work hard on you. I'm going to change you. And he does it in very simple moments. The fascinating thing about the stories of Jesus feeding thousands, you think, okay, he's the Son of God, great opportunity. There's turkey, there's stuffing, it's a huge feast of all types of food you could possibly imagine, even food they'd never heard of yet. There's Chinese food and Indian food. Jesus can do all of that, this incredible feast for them. But actually, he just multiplies fish and bread because that was the staple diet of the time. He uses the mundaneness, the normalness of life to work in us. In the normality of our lives, of your lives. Actually, every day there is a call to believe in Jesus and to trust him. So just before we finish, just pause for a second and think, actually, what is going on with me at the moment? How am I being called to trust? I wonder if those disciples could have just paused for a second in the boat, realized they were arguing about one loaf of bread with a guy who can turn it into thousands. They could have had enough bread to sink their boat. I'm thinking of pause at the moment and thought, gosh, what is God doing in me at the moment? How am I being called to trust? Another way of asking this question is to say, is God behaving in the way that I want him to? Is he answering my prayers in the way I want him to? Does he conform to my expectations? It's a big one to know whether you really trust him. Do you trust him to answer your prayers and hopes and dreams in a way that's different? The disciples, actually, if we read through the New Testament, we see them become these giants of people. So giants who we look up to and read about. And I still think this idea that that Mark's gospel was read out in a church in front of Peter, who knows if it actually happened. I think that idea is just wonderful. You can almost picture Peter grinning and saying, yep, that's the journey we went on. And look what happened. I'm now in Rome. I'm now here and there's this church planted and with people who never even met Jesus, not even of the same nationality, who are now worshipping him. Is God behaving in the way you want him to? Are we limiting him?